You know, being based in Iowa allows us the opportunity to meet and have extended conversation with just about every individual who wishes to run for President of the United States. So it is today. In just a few seconds, you'll hear from Congressman John K. Delaney of Maryland, the first Democrat to announce his run for the 2020 election. In this conversation, you'll not only hear his story, but also some solutions as to how our divided nation can become unified, including a great idea for a congressional workday. No, really. Congressman John K. Delaney for the interview coming up next. Inside on Business, the News Hour is made possible through the support of AARP Iowa. Learn about the real possibilities AARP can mean for your family, no matter the age. From tips on preventing fraud to voter information to building livable communities, there are real possibilities with AARP Iowa.
Insight on Business, the News Hour with Michael Libby is made possible through the support of Aurion, Human Resources and More for businesses and nonprofits. AURION.com. Remax Concepts, real estate professionals with offices in the Des Moines Metro, Nevada, and Cedar Rapids. RealEstateConcepts.net.
Welcome to the Business News Hour. Grateful that you have clicked through again today. We, as you well know, if you're a longtime listener, we don't necessarily do politics on the Business News Hour, except it seems like this cycle, politics and business are, well, entwined in such a level that it makes sense to perhaps cover both. And with us on the News Hour for the interview is John Delaney. He is a congressman, and he is the first announced candidate for president on the Democratic ticket for 2020. Congressman, welcome back to Iowa. Good to have you here.
It's great to be here.
I have watched your campaign for quite a while now. We first met maybe a year ago or so. And you have been crisscrossing the state of Iowa almost nonstop for a year. What's going on?
Well, we have. This is our 17th trip, I think. And I've been to all 99 counties here in Iowa. And it's been a great year. I mean, I've had an opportunity to meet so many Iowans in the past year and talk to them about their concerns, about the future, about what's going on in their communities, what they really care about, and giving them an opportunity to introduce myself to them.
And you're awfully relaxed about this.
Well, you know, I'm fairly comfortable in my own skin because I'm running on the things I believe in. And I also like to listen to people. So a lot of what I'm doing is just sitting back and hearing what people have to say and kind of reflecting on that and thinking about how that fits in with what I'm doing and learning.
Yeah, you have an incredible story for individuals who don't know. And we're going to cover a little bit of that so that people have an idea of your background. You grew up in a working class family. Your father was an electrician. You went on to school. You got a scholarship from the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers. And you graduated from two very prestigious colleges and went into business. Is that a pretty close snapshot?
That's good. Yeah, that's a good summary. It's a very unusual background for someone running for president, particularly as a Democrat. My dad was an electrician, kind of a classic blue-collar background. I ended up going to Columbia University, which was an experience that really did change my life.
I imagine.
But I would have never had an opportunity to do that but for the fact that my dad's union, the IBW, paid for about half of the tuition every year. Then from there, I went on to Georgetown to get my law degree. I met my wife at law school. She's from Idaho. Her dad was a potato farmer. So the electrician's son meets the potato farmer's daughter at Georgetown, and which was the best thing to happen to me. And we ended up staying down in the D.C. area, settled in Maryland. We have four daughters, raised our family there. I became an entrepreneur about a year after law school. I practiced law for a year and then got into my first business. It was successful. I ended up taking it public. I think I was the youngest CEO in the history of the New York Stock Exchange when I took that first company public. I ran it for 3 years, and then we sold it. And it was successful. It worked out really well. I took a year off. My wife and I became involved in our community, set up a foundation, started doing philanthropic works in our community. But I was still pretty young at the time. I was probably 36, 37, and I still had the itch to start another business. So I started my second company, which also was successful. I took that public 3 years later, and I ran it until I decided to run for office. And the decision to run for office was really about my wife and I deciding to dedicate the rest of our lives to public service. We felt like we'd live this blessed life, and had a lot of good opportunities in our lives. We, of course, worked hard, but we had a lot of helping hands along the way. And I wanted to serve the public and try to create more of those stories.
What are you hearing from voters as you crisscross not only Iowa, but, and one of the other side notes on that, at least you know the difference between Idaho and Iowa.
Yes. Yeah. Well, it's funny. My wife always jokes that those two get confused.
Oh, yeah.
And her dad, she had actually been to the Iowa State Fair before I was, when she was going to law school at Georgetown. So she went to Northwestern, and then after college went to law school like I did. And again, we met in law school. But in the summer after college, before she went to law school, she was back in Idaho. And her dad was going to drive her to Georgetown for her first year of law school. And her dad was very focused on going to the Iowa State Fair because, as a potato farmer in Idaho, this is a big deal. So she always jokes that they were on a fairly tight schedule. So they left Idaho and they literally drove for 24 straight hours so that they would make it to the Idaho State Fair so that he could have a full day before they continued on to Georgetown. And so she always points out that she knows, in fact, exactly how far it is from Idaho to Iowa, because it's 24 hours of straight driving. So.
Wait, was he a little bit disconcerted from the fact that, oh, wait a minute, there's no potatoes in Iowa?
Yeah,
we do corn
yeah.
and soybeans, hogs and cattle.
He was his name was Tom McLean, and we just lost him this past year, and he was a great guy. And someone who grew up in North Jersey in a blue-collar town, I didn't know a lot of farmers growing up. And I really enjoyed getting to know him and his intellect, and it gave me a very different perspective on the agricultural industry, and not only how astute and aware farmers are about what's going on in the world, because it all relates to the decisions they make about what crops to plant. And so I used to get involved in these terrific discussions with him often over the holidays when he was making decisions about what he was going to plant the next year. And he would be talking about his opinions about what weather patterns are
going
to be and what's happening in different parts of the country. And I'm like, well, I never realized the folks in the farming business had such a kind of a macro view of the world. And so it was a wonderful experience for me getting to know him and learning about that. So yeah, and our family is really his was a fourth generation farm. Now, unfortunately, when we met was a very tough time in the agricultural industry, which is the late 80s,
mm-hmm.
And they actually ended up losing the family farm. So it was kind of a difficult situation. But
John Delaney is our guest for the interview, the first announced Democratic candidate for president in 2020. Let's get into some policy discussions and some current issues. You have four daughters.
I do.
The current mood in this country relative to politics and women in the future has got to be hitting home for you.
Yes. Yeah, there's things that have happened in this country, particularly in the last couple of years, that have really, I could see the pain in my daughter's eyes. And I think this most recent Supreme Court confirmation process was something much bigger than Judge Kavanaugh's confirmation process. And I've tended to talk about this differently than other people, which is there was the specifics around Judge Kavanaugh's confirmation. But then there was a much bigger issue that his nomination really brought to the surface. Whether you supported him or not, or no matter what side of these facts you actually believed, there was something much bigger going on that obviously existed in this country. And it would have come to the surface either now or in some time in the near future. It just took an event to actually precipitate it. And I think in many ways, this confirmation process was that event. And so it was much bigger than him or the specific facts around this case. Again, I don't want to get into that. It's done. We need to move on. I hope he becomes a very successful justice. But clearly, women and victims have suffered for a long time in this country and have not felt that they were in the kind of environment where they could come forward and tell people their stories and feel safe about it. And that's an issue we got to wrestle with.
John Delaney, ladies and gentlemen, as we take a look at not that process, but the division that goes on here in the United States, one of the knocks on John Delaney is that you're too bipartisan. And you know, people say, well, you know, you talk too much to the other side. You're in conference with right. Republicans. Well, what the hell are you doing? This is craziness. We've got to build barriers and walls,
right.
And identity politics is the thing to do.
Well, they're wrong. And I feel pretty comfortable saying that, because if you look back across time, if you look at all the great things that we've done in this country, we've done those things by having broad support for them, which means by definition, we've had bipartisan support. So I don't view bipartisanship in and of itself as an end game or a goal. It's a way you actually make big things happen. And as someone who is an entrepreneur, again, I started these two companies and took them public before I was 40. I'm a real action-oriented person, and I really think there's a much better story to tell about this country and where it's going, but it requires us to do things. It requires us to actually get things done. And the only way to get things done is to build big coalitions. And so I'm about progress, and I'm about action, and I'm about finding common ground so that we can get some things done. Because I want the next 20 years to play out better than the last 20 years have played out for the American people. And if we keep fighting, if we keep building walls and divisions and refusing to listen to what the other side says, then we're not going to accomplish any of those things. And the only people who will win in that world are the politicians, and the American people will lose. So, yeah, I'm pretty comfortable with the approach I have. I think it's the right answer for the American people.
I'm an old guy, so I happen to remember when Tip
O'Neill... You're not that old.
Oh, yeah, I am. I knew Marconi. He was a personal friend.
Got it.
I remember when Tip O'Neill was Speaker of the House and Ronald Reagan was the president. Yet, this country tackled many, many, many issues and got some things done under very divergent political views. Is that where we need to get back to?
Absolutely. I think about it simply. And, you know, the best way to talk about it is in the typical life of an American. Most Americans work really hard. So let's say your average American gets into work at 8 o'clock and leaves at 6. What I think members of Congress should be doing, and our elected officials, is they ought to spend, say, 8 to 12 arguing about things they really care about. You know, the battle of ideas, trying to convince the other side that they're right. Because that's healthy. We ought to embrace that in a democracy. We ought to have a respectful debate about the big issues of the day. And people come at these issues from different perspectives. Then they ought to have lunch, and they ought to come back and say from 12:30 to 6, they ought to work on the things where there's common ground. Wouldn't that be a much better way if our government actually ran like that? And that's kind of the way I think it worked historically. Ronald Reagan and Tip O'Neill did absolutely not agree with each other on everything. They had very different views on some very big and important issues of the day, and they tried to change each other's mind and change the country's mind. But they also rolled up their sleeves and got some things done, including, by the way, strengthening Social Security for 50 years. They actually worked on a bipartisan basis to strengthen Social Security, which they were able to do. They extended its solvency for 50 years, and the poverty rate of seniors has been cut in half since they did that. And so that's an area where I've actually found bipartisan support. I have the only bipartisan bill in the Congress to extend the solvency of Social Security for 75 years. That's the kind of stuff we should be doing. Would the country be better served if we fight about it for another 10 years and then it becomes insolvent? That's kind of how I look at these issues.
There is a movement, I understand, in Congress right now. Congressman McCarthy is preparing a bill to fully fund the wall between the United States and Mexico. That's not necessarily bipartisan politics, is it?
It is not. See, that's not a constructive approach. What is a constructive approach is to do comprehensive immigration reform along the lines that it was able to be done on a bipartisan basis about 6 years ago. So 6 years ago, there was a bipartisan bill that came out of the Senate. 15 senators voted for it, and I think pretty much all the Democrats. 15 Republican senators, and I think pretty much all the Democrats. And Obama would have signed it into law, and if it would have got a vote on the House floor, it would have passed. And what that bill did is three things. It put $40 billion into border security. So you know how the president wants $25 billion for a wall? This bill had $40 billion in border security, which included barriers and technology and additional investments in people. So it actually had more money on border security. It also reformed our visa programs, which really do need to be reformed in this country for both high-skilled and low-skilled workers. And then what it also did is it took the 11 million undocumented residents in this country and it actually created a pathway. A 13-year, you can commit a crime, you have to learn English, but and you have to start paying taxes, pathway for them to get legal status. That's what McCarthy should be doing, because that bill, like something like 70 or 75% of the American people support that approach. That approach is pro-growth, it's pro-border security, and I think it's pro-humanity, quite frankly. And that's, if I was president, that would be in my first 100 days, to take that bipartisan deal that's basically already been cut in this country and actually get it done.
John Delaney is our guest, ladies and gentlemen, congressman from Maryland.
Maryland.
And from time to time, we do pay attention to what's going on in Maryland. We had your former governor here
often.
And I want to talk just a minute about wages and business. Ro Khanna, a friend of yours,
yes,
no doubt, who represents the Silicon Valley,
yes,
California
17. Very smart guy.
Smart guy, yeah. We had him on the broadcast last week or the week before when Amazon said, hey, look, we're going to raise wages for our Amazon workers to $15 an hour.
Yep. Wow,
made big news. Senator Bernie Sanders was all over that.
Sure.
Ro Khanna was all over that. The next day, they said, oh, but wait, we're going to be able to pay for that. We're going to take away bonus programs and also stock options for our employees. Yesterday, long-term employees of Amazon are railing against the issue. Amazon, in the meantime, says, oh, look, we're going to fix this. We're going to make this right. The fight for 15 seems to be a rallying call for many individuals. When you're out crisscrossing not only Iowa but the United States, what are you hearing from constituents with regard to wages, wage equity, and the balance in the United States between those who are extremely wealthy and those who are working sometimes two and three jobs to get by?
So there's a lot of anxiety around this issue, and there's a lot of pain around this issue, quite frankly. I mean, you're putting your finger on the exact issue in this country right now, which is wages and benefits and pay. It's actually much less jobs, right? There are jobs in this country. Unemployment is low.
Yeah, 3.7.
That's right.
Here.
The issue is around pay, wages, and benefits. Because technology, which has been so transformative to our lives in so many ways, has basically allowed there to be a lot of productivity in the private sector without a lot of that productivity going to wages. There's also been and continues to be a healthcare crisis in this country. And healthcare costs have grown much faster than the economy. And so in many ways, if you look back over 20 years, you see that productivity increases have largely gone to pay healthcare. And instead, it should have gone to give Americans a raise. So I'm a big supporter of not only increasing the minimum wage, right? So $15 an hour is fine. We can have a debate about how you get there, you know, how you phase it in. Do you have carve-outs for, you know, young workers who are working in high school? All that stuff should be debated, but we should be adjusting the minimum wage up. But the other thing we need to do is something much bigger and more transformative, which is to double something called the Earned Income Tax Credit, the EITC, which is the most direct way of helping workers in this country because it actually gives them a check at the end of the year. But to get that check, you have to work. And that's what, in my opinion, makes it such a successful program, because you're not giving people money to do nothing. You're actually targeting hardworking Americans, many of which are working two or three jobs to get by, and you're giving them a tax break. That's a much better tax break to give this country than a tax break for wealthier Americans, in my opinion. So I think we need to do something transformative, and I think this issue is just going to get worse. It is estimated that technological innovation will displace or change 50 million jobs by 2040. So by 2040, 22 years from now, 50 million jobs in this country will either go away or be changed dramatically. And when they say being changed dramatically, what that really means is them being devalued. And I'll give you an example. There was some stuff going on in retailers in this country in the last year where they would actually set up cameras. These are big box retailers, right? So think like the, you know, the Targets of the world. I'm not saying they specifically, but those kind of things. They'd set up cameras and they'd film customers coming in for the first hour that the store was open. And then they'd look at the weather and they'd look at traffic patterns, and all that would get dumped into a computer, and the algorithm would predict how many shoppers they would have for the rest of the day. And with that information, they would send out texts to workers saying, you don't have to come in today. So if you think about that, if you're a hard worker and you plan to work that day and you really need that money to get by, technology has allowed you basically to not work that day. And so these are some of the issues that we have to address as a society. We need big new ideas like I have to create effectively a future where we can be competitive, where our economy can grow, but where workers are protected, where if they work 40 hours a week, they earn a decent wage and get the kind of benefits where they can support their family. That is the biggest issue right now in the country. And if you do that, people don't care if someone's successful. People don't care. I mean, listen, I started with nothing. I became successful. I have never had anyone push back on that success. They actually think that's what this country is about. But they also like the fact that I spend my time fighting for workers.
John Delaney, ladies and gentlemen, let's go back to this healthcare conversation, if we can, for just a moment. I want to tell you a story about a very successful nonprofit here in Greater Des Moines Metro. And this very successful nonprofit has an executive director, and they're a business-centric nonprofit. They are in the business community, over 750 members. I was speaking to their president and executive director not long ago, and I said, "How you doing?" And she says, "I'm really tired." I said, "What's going on?" She said, "Well, we had to let our office manager go." I said, "What? You got 750 members? What are you talking about?" And she says, "Well, the income stream simply isn't what it used to be." And I said, "Well, I can imagine maybe employers are out there having to spend more money on recruitment and retention with such a low unemployment number here in the Greater Des Moines Metro. It's really low, 2.7, I think it is." What? She said, "Well, that's part of it. The other part is that we're finding our small to mid-size employers having to spend so much money on health care."
Yes.
19, 20, 25% increases in premiums. How long is that sustainable, Congressman?
It is not sustainable for long. The business person in me looks at the financial condition of this country and our financial future, and I pull out my red pen and I circle healthcare costs because it's actually the only number that really matters. If we continue to allow healthcare grow at 2 to 3 times the rate of inflation, it will gobble up all the productivity in this country. It is not the highest kind of return on investment we make. And it's going to continue to affect wages. And it's a huge problem. And it's particularly a problem because we don't get better returns for it. So if you look at what we spend as a country, we spend about $9,000 per person on health care in this country. Our competitors, if you look at the kind of countries that we would view as competitors, Germany, places like this, they're spending anywhere from kind of $4,000 to $6,000 per person. We're spending $9,000. So we're spending a lot more, and we're not getting more in return. In fact, if you look at some of our outcomes, we're doing no better than the world on average. So we're spending more. We're not getting better health care. I mean, we have terrific health care at the top, but on average, things like maternal health and those kind of things are not actually better than what you're seeing around the world. So reforming our health care system, coming up with a universal health care system where everyone gets health care as a right, but also gives Americans options, controls cost, and deals with quality is the most important thing for the economic future of this country.
You're a business guy. And so when you're, as a business guy, and I think this is an interesting conversation, when you take a look at what the federal government is already spending for health care.
Yes.
And then you take that and you put it over on the, some call it Medicare for all, some call it universal health. The dollars spent, according to the people who are the economists, say, well, you know, we'd be spending less money if we had that kind of a system. What is keeping us from getting there?
Well, what's keeping us from getting there is kind of the practical transition. So healthcare is 1/6 of the U.S. economy. If the U.S. healthcare system was its own country, it would be one of the largest countries in the world if you measure it by economic size. And so you don't throw that system out the window and start from scratch, because you just can't do that. It's too big a system. So what we need in this country is a long-term plan and vision for how we actually take where we are now and get us to a much better place in 10 years. And that's what I have. So unlike other people's proposal, which basically says, scrap the system, let's start this new system from scratch. And my point is, yeah, that's an interesting idea, but that's impossible to do because it's already 1/6 of the economy. You can't scrap it overnight. What my plan does is basically create universal access right away and then starts reforming the system so you end up with one of those type systems that people envision over time. That's the business person in me, the entrepreneur in me. I'm like, hey, innovative idea, but I can practically make it work. That's what's stopping us from doing it. We're too short-term in our orientation. You can't fix the U.S. healthcare system in 1 year.
There's also some entrenchment, individuals would
yes.
say, with regard to pharmaceutical companies, yes. drug makers, the medical community as a whole. Here in Iowa, for example, it's stunning when you take a look at this. The Iowa Hospital Association is crying, especially in rural hospitals out there, because they can't find people.
Right.
They can't get a payment system.
Right.
I mean, it is a dire thing. And in many communities, not only in Iowa, but across rural America, that is the major employer in that county.
Absolutely.
And, yeah.
Well, healthcare, as I said, it's become over 1/6 of our economy. So anywhere you go in this country, 1 out of 6 dollars spent is on healthcare. So literally, in this whole country, it's getting close to 1/5. Right, almost between 1 out of 6 to 1 out of 5 of every dollar spent in this country is on healthcare. So it's not a surprise that in pretty much every community, healthcare is the biggest employer. Now, some of this is for good reasons. I mean, we've come up with innovations that have fundamentally changed our lives. They've allowed children that were born prematurely to live. They've allowed people who had illnesses that used to be fatal to become chronic or cured. We all know these stories. But all those things cost money, too. And they've extended our lives, which is fabulous, but we also use a lot more healthcare when we're older. So there's some good reasons that healthcare costs are up. I mean, we could have 1950s cost healthcare, but we'd have 1950s quality healthcare. No one wants that. So we just need to be honest about the problems and honest about the solutions. And I, as a business person who understands finance and understands healthcare, my first business was actually involved in healthcare. I know how to fix this system, and that's what we have to do. And you mentioned the pharmaceutical companies. This is something that I love to talk with people in the business community about because I believe in capitalism. I believe in the free markets. I think we need to make them more just and inclusive, but I absolutely believe it's the best system. In a free market system, the person with purchasing power gets the best deal. The U.S. government is the largest buyer of pharmaceuticals in the world. But by law, we are prohibited from using that buying power that we have on behalf of the taxpayers of this country, we're prohibited from using it to negotiate pharmaceutical prices. And so what that really is, that's a wealth transfer from the taxpayers of this country to the stockholders of pharmaceutical companies. And that has to stop as part of any reform. That should stop today. I mean, it's ridiculous. Imagine like Walmart not being able to negotiate the prices of things. That's kind of what we're talking about here.
Congressman John Delaney, as we close this out, Congressman, and thank you again for carving out so much time for us today on the interview.
No, it's great to be here. I love talking about this stuff.
I could tell. One of the things that I think many Americans are having issues with, and they may not understand, but you're a business guy. Can we talk a little bit about tariffs
sure.
and the impact that that's having? You know, I was just recently in rural Iowa at a farm ag summit, listening to a senator from New Jersey, as a matter of fact. He was in town talking about agriculture and issues that revolve around payment systems. The tariffs against soybeans are really detrimental to the rural economy, now in its fifth year of decline, by the way. But that's not the only issue that this is going to impact, the $200 billion more in tariffs from the administration. That's going to start to affect refrigerators, and televisions, and
right.
iPhones, you name it. We've got a lot of stuff out there. When will the public take a look at that and their pocketbook and say, wait a minute, is this any way to create a trade system?
Well, I think they're going to start seeing it soon. I mean, because as you rightly said, this has hurt agricultural prices, it's hurt Iowa, and it will increasingly hurt consumers because the cost of what goes into manufacturing will go up. Whether it's home building, this will obviously cause an increase in the prices of homes or other things. What is so disappointing about the president's trade war with China is that we have a very big issue with China, but this is actually not the issue. right? The president looks at the trade deficit with China, and he's concluded...
Which increased, by the way.
Yes, that's right. And he's concluded that that's a big problem. But in reality, the real big problem with China is that they actually steal intellectual property. China's become our peer or our rival economically by doing three things. They invested wisely, they worked really hard, and they didn't play by the rules. And we need to, on a go-forward basis, work with our allies around the world and all of U.S. business. We have to get the U.S. business community on the same page. And we have to go to China with an organized front and say, no more. And that's what the president should be doing. He should be building kind of a coalition of our businesses and European businesses and European countries and Mexico and Canada and getting us all on the same page and saying, listen, we understand there may be short-term pain. In other words, China may not be investing as much in our countries, et cetera, but we are not going to do business with you unless you change the way you deal with intellectual property going forward. That is the greatest risk to us, not whether we have a trade deficit with them on steel or something like that.
Final question, Congressman, and thank you again for taking so much time to be with us. Usually these interviews go about 16 to 18 minutes. We're well over that. But I think these are topics and discussions that not only voters across the spectrum need to know, but the business community needs right. to have a better understanding moving forward. And if you have answers to that, that all sort of makes sense. What would you like Iowans or Americans to know about John Delaney that they may not know?
Well, I'd like them to know that I have a plan for workers and for our businesses. So I'm pro-worker and pro-business. I think they go hand in hand. I think they go hand in hand. Look, I believe in capitalism. I think it's the greatest innovation machine the world's ever seen. But it absolutely has to be made more just and inclusive. And we need to think completely differently about workers' rights and workers' protections in this country so that as we grow our economy and as we continue to do smart things to ensure that the United States is as competitive as possible and that our companies win in the international stage and compete really well, that workers also are protected and can manage through that transition. And I think what makes me unique is that I do come from a blue-collar background. My dad was in a union, so I understand what it's like to be in a working family. I was a very successful entrepreneur, and now I've been in government, coming up with big ideas as part of being in the Congress of the United States. So in many ways, if you think about what our challenge is, I have the absolute right background to deal with those challenges.
It's kind of the three-legged stool, right?
That's right.
All right. John Delaney, ladies and gentlemen, for the interview. Thank you so much, Congressman.
Great to be here.
That, once again, was an extended visit with Congressman John K. Delaney of Maryland, who is running for president in the 2020 election. Feel free to rewind and hear his thoughts again. Stay with us. More to come on the Business News Hour.